Hey, I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Welcome to BS Killer Book Autopsy.
15 million copies.
15.
The biggest nonfiction book of the last decade. Bigger than Sapiens. Bigger than Thinking Fast and Slow. Bigger than every Malcolm Gladwell book combined.
James Clear's Atomic Habits, published 2018. It promises to show you how tiny changes produce remarkable results.
And it does. Kind of. But not for the reasons Clear says.
We autopsied all 20 chapters from the primary text, checked every study he cites, verified every quote, traced every anecdote to its origin.
And here's what nobody tells you about Atomic Habits. Almost nothing in it is original.
Nothing?
Almost nothing. The Habit Loop is Charles Duhigg's from 2012. The Tiny Habits concept is B.J. Fogg's. The environment design comes from Thaler and Sunstein's Nudge. The identity idea draws from self-determination theory. The systems versus goals framework is Scott Adams from How to Fail in Almost Everything and Still Win Big. The compound effect framing is Darren Hardy.
So what did Clear actually contribute?
Organization, clarity, accessibility. He made all of it usable for someone who will never read an academic paper.
And sometimes the best remix album is better than all the originals. That's actually the argument for this book.
The scorecard. BS, 3.5 out of 10. Genuinely low for self-help. Edge, 7.5. You will actually use things from this book. Replicability, 6. Most of it works. Some of it depends on who you are and what you control.
Here's the next 40 minutes. The man behind the book, the framework that actually works, 3 studies we verified that are rock solid, the math that's completely wrong, the story that's probably fake, the identity insight most readers miss, and what the book refuses to talk about.
Let's go.
Okay, so James Clear, born 1986, grew up in Hamilton, Ohio, played baseball at Denison University. Unremarkable so far.
Until sophomore year, 2004.
A teammate's bat slips during a practice swing, hits Clear in the face, full force, breaks his nose, shatters both eye sockets. The bat pushes his eyeballs back into his skull.
He goes into a coma that night. They put him on a ventilator. He has multiple seizures.
Pages 8 through 15, he describes waking up and not being able to see clearly, having to breathe through a tube taped to his nose for months, his left eye bulging out of its socket. He couldn't drive for 8 months, missing the entire season.
And this is one of the most serious injuries you can survive in a sport that isn't supposed to be contact.
But here's where the story gets interesting. He goes back to baseball, slowly, not like a movie montage, slowly like months of frustration slowly.
He makes the team again junior year. Barely plays, rides the bench mostly, gets a few at-bats.
Senior year, he starts. By his final season at Denison, he's named to the ESPN Academic All-America team, Capital One First Team.
Now, this is a Division III school, not the major leagues, not even close. But going from a coma with your eyeballs pushed into your skull to Academic All-America in 3 years is a legitimate comeback.
And the lesson he takes from this is not talent, not grit, not willpower. The lesson is small improvements every day. He calls them atomic habits.
He's very clear about this in the book. He wasn't the most talented player. He just showed up every day, did one more rep, studied one more hour, slept 1 hour earlier, and the increments compounded.
Whether or not the math of compounding applies literally, and we'll get to that, the lived experience clearly shaped everything he wrote. Now, after college, he doesn't become a researcher. He doesn't get a PhD in behavioral science. He starts a blog.
JamesClear.com, 2012. He commits to publishing 2 articles per week, every Monday and Thursday, and he just keeps going.
And here's the irony. His own career is the best proof of his thesis. He didn't have a viral moment. He didn't get discovered. He published consistently for 6 years, 250 plus articles before the book.
The compound effect in action, not the fake math version, the real version. Show up, improve, repeat. Over years.
Within 2 years, he's at 100,000 email subscribers. By 2015, 200,000. By 2017, over 500,000. 500,000 people reading a free newsletter about habits. Penguin Random House comes knocking with a 7-figure book deal.
And this raises the key question about atomic habits. The question that shapes whether you see this book as brilliant or derivative. James Clear is a blogger who synthesized academic research. He didn't run the studies, he didn't develop the theories, he didn't spend decades in a lab. He read the papers, understood them better than most, and repackaged them for a general audience. Is that a feature or a bug?
It's a feature.
Why?
because B.J. Fogg's Tiny Habits is 320 pages of academic writing that most people won't finish. Duhigg's Power of Habit is great storytelling, but the framework is harder to apply. Fowler and Sunstein's Nudge is brilliant, but it's written for policymakers, not individuals.
Clear took all of that and made it usable, like a great teacher who doesn't invent calculus but explains it better than anyone else.
Exactly. The complaint that Clear isn't original misses the point. The originals are harder to read. The remix is what people actually use.
There's actually a good analogy here. Richard Feynman didn't invent quantum electrodynamics. He invented a way to explain it that everyone could understand, the Feynman diagrams. Nobody calls Feynman a fraud because Schwinger and Tominaga did the same math differently.
And Clear is doing something similar, taking rigorous work and making it visual, memorable, actionable.
But you should know it's a remix, because some of what he added, the polish, the anecdotes, the viral math, that's where the BS creeps in.
And that's what the rest of this episode is about.
Four laws. Make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. That's the entire book in 12 words.
And to break bad habits, you invert them. Make it invisible, make it unattractive, make it difficult, make it unsatisfying.
Simple, memorable, diagnostic. When a habit isn't sticking, you run it through the four laws, and usually one of them is broken.
But where does this come from? Because Clear didn't invent the habit loop.
Short pause. Edward Thorndike, 1898. Puzzle boxes with cats. A cat is placed in a wooden box. There's a lever that opens the door. At first, the cat scratches and claws randomly. Eventually, it accidentally hits the lever. Door opens. Cat gets food. Thorndike repeats the experiment. Each time, the cat gets faster at finding the lever.
The law of effect. Behaviors followed by satisfying consequences tend to be repeated. Behaviors followed by unpleasant consequences tend to disappear. 1898, over 120 years ago.
So the foundation of habit science is older than the airplane.
Older than the airplane. Older than radio. Thorndike published this when Queen Victoria was still alive.
Then Charles Duhigg, in 2012, writes The Power of Habit. He simplifies Thorndike into a three-part loop. Cue, routine, reward. The cue triggers the habit, the routine is the behavior, the reward is what your brain gets out of it.
Clear takes Duhigg's loop and expands it. Cue becomes cue plus craving, routine becomes response, reward stays reward. So it's cue, craving, response, reward. Four stages instead of three.
Short pause. The addition of craving is actually important because it's not just that you see the cue. You have to want something. The cue triggers a craving, which motivates the response, which delivers the reward.
And each of the four laws maps to one stage. Make it obvious targets the cue. Make it attractive targets the craving. Make it easy targets the response. Make it satisfying targets the reward.
Short pause. And the inversions for breaking bad habits. Make it invisible hides the cue. Make it unattractive kills the craving. Make it difficult, increases friction on the response. Make it unsatisfying, removes the reward.
So, if you want to stop checking your phone in bed, make it invisible, leave it in another room. Make it difficult, put it in a drawer with a combination lock if you have to.
A combination lock on your phone drawer? Whatever it takes. The point is friction. Every second of friction between you and the bad habit is a second for your brain to disengage.
It's a diagnostic checklist. Let me walk you through it with a positive habit example.
Go.
You want to go to the gym, but you never do. Law one. Is the cue obvious? Is your gym bag packed and sitting by the door, or is your workout gear buried in a drawer somewhere? Law two. Is it attractive? Do you have a workout buddy, a playlist you love? Do you pair it with something enjoyable?
Law three. Is it easy? Is the gym on your commute or 30 minutes out of your way? Do you have to drive across town at rush hour?
Law 4. Is it satisfying? Do you track your workouts? Do you feel good after? Or do you just feel exhausted and wonder why you bothered?
Usually the answer is Law 3. The friction is too high. The gym is too far. The workout is too long. The routine is too complicated.
And this is where Clear's two-minute rule comes in. Chapter 13. Scale any habit down to something you can do in 2 minutes. Don't say, I'll run 5 miles. Say, I'll put on my running shoes. Don't say, I'll read 30 pages. Say, I'll read one page.
That's B.J. Fogg's Tiny Habits repackaged. Fogg calls it making the behavior tiny. Clear calls it the two-minute rule. Same idea, different branding.
Clear credits Fogg in Chapter 5, but by Chapter 13, the two-minute rule is presented as Clear's own framework. No citation.
Is that plagiarism?
it's self-help. The line between synthesis and appropriation gets blurry when you're writing for a mass audience, but you should know the origin.
And that matters, because Fogg spent 20 years at Stanford developing this, running experiments, refining the model. Clear spent a weekend writing a blog post about it. Both are valid contributions, but they're not equal contributions.
Fair. But here's the counter. Fogg's book sold maybe 500,000 copies. Clear's sold 15 million. 30 times more people actually have the tool. Who helped more?
That's like saying McDonald's helped more people eat than Julia Child because they sold more burgers.
Except in this case, the burger is nutritionally identical. The framework is the same. The packaging is different.
The framework works. That's the bottom line. Whether Clear invented it is irrelevant to whether it helps. And it helps.
Okay, three studies. These are the load-bearing pillars of Atomic Habits. We verified each one against the original papers.
Study one, the Vietnam Heroin Study, Chapter 7, The Secret to Self-Control.
1971. Members of Congress visit Vietnam. They discover something terrifying. Over 15% of U.S. soldiers stationed there are heroin addicts. Follow-up research by Lee Robbins shows 35% have tried heroin. 20% are addicted.
The government panics, creates the Special Action Office of Drug Abuse Prevention, brings in Robbins, a psychiatrist from Washington University, to track what happens when these soldiers come home.
And here's where it gets extraordinary. Of the soldiers who used heroin in Vietnam, only 5% became re-addicted within a year after returning home. Just 12% relapsed within 3 years. 9 out of 10 kicked the habit, almost overnight.
Compare that to normal drug rehab, 90% relapse rate.
90 versus 5.
That's not a modest difference. That's an 18-fold difference.
Why? Because Vietnam was saturated with cues. Stress, easy access, fellow users. Everyone around you was doing it. When soldiers came home, every single one of those cues vanished. Different streets, different people, different routines. The environment changed. The habit died.
This study is real. Published by Lee Robbins in Archives of General Psychiatry, 1974. Cited over 1,000 times. We verified it. Clear presents it accurately on pages 81 through 85.
And it leads to the book's strongest insight. Page 85, quote, "Self-control is a short-term strategy, not a long-term one. You may be able to resist temptation once or twice, but it's unlikely you can muster the willpower to override your desires every time."
Page 81, "The people with the best self-control are typically the ones who need to use it the least."
Read that again. The most disciplined people aren't white-knuckling through temptation. They've designed their lives so temptation rarely shows up.
The prescription isn't resist temptation, it's remove it.
And this connects to something we covered in episode 2. Kahneman and Tversky's work shows that system 2 is lazy. It doesn't want to engage. Willpower requires system 2. So relying on willpower is relying on the laziest part of your brain.
Which is exactly why environment design beats motivation every single time. You're not fighting your brain, you're routing around the lazy part, making the good behavior the default path so system 2 never even has to engage.
Study 2, Implementation Intentions, Chapter 5, pages 62 through 65. This is the most rigorous evidence in the entire book.
2002. Researchers Sarah Milne, Sheena Orbell, and Pascal Sheehan. 248 people in Britain. Three groups. Group 1 just tracks their exercise. Control group. Group 2 gets a motivational presentation about why exercise prevents heart disease. Group 3 does the same motivational presentation, but then writes down a single sentence. "I will exercise at blank time in blank place on blank day."
Results. Groups 1 and 2, 35-38% exercised at least once per week. No difference between them. The motivation made zero impact.
Group 3, 91%.
91!
From 38-91 by writing one sentence.
Just writing down when and where you'll exercise more than doubled compliance. The motivational speech, the one about heart disease and death and all the scary statistics, it did nothing. The sentence did everything.
Published in the British Journal of Health Psychology, replicated dozens of times. Hundreds of follow-up studies confirm that implementation intentions work across domains. exercise, diet, voting, medication adherence, studying.
Clear calls this the best way to start a new habit, page 62. And for once, the self-help claim matches the science perfectly.
I actually tried this. I wrote down, I will write at 6 a.m. at my desk before checking email. And it worked. Not because of magic, because it removed the decision. The when and where were pre-decided. My system too didn't have to engage.
Which is exactly why it works. You're not deciding in the moment. You decided last Tuesday. The moment just executes the decision.
Study 3, Karachi handwashing. Chapter 15, pages 147 through 155.
Late 1990s, Stephen Luby, epidemiologist, working in the squatter settlements of Karachi, Pakistan. Over 60% of the city's residents live in what the study calls squatter settlements. Contaminated water, no proper sanitation, nearly a third of children malnourished.
Luby and his team knew hand washing could prevent disease. And here's the thing, people already knew hand washing was important. They just did it poorly, with low-quality soap that barely lathered.
So they partnered with Procter & Gamble, gave residents Safeguard soap, premium soap. It foamed easily, smelled great, made the act of hand-washing slightly more pleasant.
Results within months. Diarrhea in children under 5 fell 52%, pneumonia down 48%. Impetigo, a bacterial skin infection, down 35%.
But here's the part that genuinely blew my mind. They went back 6 years later. Over 95% of households that had been given free soap still maintained a hand washing station with soap and water available. They hadn't received free soap for 5 years, but the habit stuck.
This is Luby et al., published in The Lancet 2005. Verified. The fourth law, make it satisfying. Nice-smelling soap is not a trivial detail. It's the mechanism that made the habit persist across years.
The information didn't change behavior. The motivation didn't change behavior. Making the behavior slightly more enjoyable changed behavior, and it stuck for half a decade without any further intervention.
And notice the pattern across all three studies. Vietnam, the environment changed and addiction vanished. Implementation intentions. The decision was made in advance and compliance tripled. Karachi, the experience improved and the habit persisted for years.
None of them relied on willpower, none of them relied on motivation, none of them relied on understanding why the behavior mattered.
Page 20, habits are the compound interest of self-improvement. That's the quote everyone remembers. But the real compound interest isn't the 1% daily gains. It's these three mechanisms, environment, implementation, satisfaction. Stack those and the habits compound on their own.
Three studies, Vietnam heroin, implementation intentions, Karachi handwashing. These are the pillars. The rest of the book is built on anecdotes, but these three are solid. Now, the parts that don't hold up.
Page 17, the most shared claim in the book. Quote, habits are the compound interest of self-improvement. If you can get 1% better each day for 1 year, you'll end up 37 times better by the time you're done.
1.01 to the power of 365 equals 37.78.
The math is correct.
And completely meaningless.
Right. Human performance does not compound exponentially. You can't get 1% stronger every day and end up benching 37 times your starting weight.
If you bench press 100 pounds and improve 1% daily in 1 year, you'd be pressing 3,778 pounds.
The world record is 701 pounds by Julius Maddox in 2020.
The math is a metaphor dressed up as a formula. It's marketing, not science. Clear never claims it applies literally, but it's there on page 17 with a graph looking like a fact. And that graph has been shared on Instagram 11 million times.
The real insight is direction, not magnitude. Small improvements in the right direction matter more than big efforts in the wrong direction. You don't need fake math to make that point.
But fake math is more shareable than real nuance.
Always has been.
Bullshit item 2, British cycling.
Chapter 1, Dave Brailsford takes over British cycling in 2003, applies the aggregation of marginal gains, 1% improvements to everything, tires, seats, pillows, hand gel, mattresses. Britain goes from nearly zero Olympic medals to dominating the Tour de France and the Olympics.
Great story. Massive survivorship bias.
What Clear omits. First, British cycling received a massive funding increase from UK Sport. We're talking tens of millions of pounds. That tends to help.
Second, multiple riders on Brailsford's teams were later implicated in doping investigations. Bradley Wiggins received a therapeutic use exemption for triamcinolone, a powerful corticosteroid, right before his biggest races. A UK anti-doping investigation called it crossing an ethical line.
Third, the marginal gain story is told entirely from the winner's perspective. Dozens of other cycling programs made similar small improvements and achieved nothing. You only hear about Brailsford because he won.
The principles behind marginal gains are valid. Systematic improvement works. But the British cycling story, as told in this book, is a fairy tale with the messy parts removed.
And here's the thing that really bothers me. Clear knows this. He's a careful writer. He chose to tell the clean version because the clean version sells books. The messy version sells subscriptions to cycling magazines.
Different audiences.
Different audiences. Same truth. But only one version made it into the book.
Bullshit item 3, the photography class story.
Chapter 11, Walk Slowly But Never Backward. Page 116. Jerry Elsman, a professor at the University of Florida, divides his film photography students into two groups. The quantity group is graded on number of photos submitted. The quality group is graded on a single perfect photo. End of semester, all the best photos come from the quantity group.
Great story. Very memorable. One problem.
It almost certainly didn't happen this way. The story first appears in a 1993 book called Art and Fear by David Bales and Ted Orland. And in that version, it's a ceramics class, not photography. The teacher is unnamed. The measurement is weight of pots, not number of photos.
Clear attributes it to Yelsman, who is a real photographer and real professor at the University of Florida. But there's no published source for this experiment happening in a photography class. No paper, no department record, no corroboration.
What probably happened is the Art and Fear ceramics story got retold and morphed. Someone somewhere swapped ceramics for photography and attached a famous professor's name. Classic folklore. Does it invalidate the point? No. Practice beats perfection. Repetition beats overthinking. That's well established in learning science. But the specific story is probably fabricated.
And there's a pattern here. The principles are solid. The evidence behind them is real. But the anecdotes used to make them memorable are sometimes smoothed.
Bullshit item 4, Christakis and Fowler's Obesity Contagion Study.
Chapter 9. Clear cites a study claiming obesity spreads through social networks. If your friend becomes obese, your chance of obesity increases by 57%.
This study has been methodologically contested since it was published. Russell Lyons at Indiana University argued the statistical model confuses homophily, birds of a feather, with actual contagion. People who are already similar choose each other as friends. They don't make each other fat.
It's the same error as the Hangry Judges study from episode 2, a correlation that looks like causation because nobody checked for the boring explanation.
And Clear uses it to support his argument about the power of social environment, which is a real thing. Social influence on behavior is well documented, but this particular study is the wrong evidence for the right claim, which is the whole pattern with this book. Right claims, sometimes wrong evidence, sometimes smoothed evidence. Sometimes fabricated stories.
The overall pattern? Solid principles, real science underneath, but wrapped in smoothed anecdotes and viral math that make the book easier to sell and harder to trust.
Chapter 2. This is the insight most readers either miss entirely or forget by page 50.
Three layers of behavior change. Layer 1. Outcomes. What you get. I want to lose weight. I want to make more money. Layer 2. Processes, what you do. I'll follow this diet, I'll use this budget. Layer 3, identity, who you are.
Most people work from the outside in. They start with outcomes and try to build processes to get there. Clear says you should work from the inside out, start with identity.
Pages 31 through 41. His example is perfect. Two people are offered a cigarette.
Person 1 says, no thanks, I'm trying to quit.
Person 2 says, no thanks, I'm not a smoker.
Same behavior, radically different psychology. Person 1 still identifies as a smoker who is fighting the urge. Person 2 has shifted identity. The battle is over. There's nothing to fight.
And then comes the line that is genuinely the best sentence in this book, page 38. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
No single instance will transform your beliefs, but as the votes build up, so does the evidence of your new identity.
That's it. That's the whole book in two sentences. Your habits are votes. Cast enough of them and the election result changes. You don't decide to become a reader. You read one page, then another, then another. Eventually, the evidence is overwhelming. You are a reader.
And Clear backs this up with a story about Brian Clark, a nail biter for years. He didn't set a goal to stop biting his nails. He started getting manicures. Once his nails looked good, he didn't want to ruin them. The identity shifted from someone who bites his nails to someone who takes care of his hands.
The habit died because the identity changed, not the other way around.
And this works for building habits too. You don't say, "I'm going to meditate every day." You say, "I'm the kind of person who is calm and centered." Then meditating becomes obvious. It's what that person would do.
You don't say, "I'm going to write 1,000 words every day." You say, "I'm a writer." Then the writing happens because that's who you are. Skipping a day feels wrong, like lying about yourself.
And that's the power of it. Guilt and willpower are terrible motivators, but identity is a fantastic one because you're not pushing yourself to do something hard. You're just being yourself.
The most effective behavior change is identity change. That's the thesis of chapter 2, and it's the deepest idea in the book.
Now, here's where it gets genuinely interesting, because most podcasts about this book stop at chapter 2 and say identity is everything, but there's a twist.
Chapter 20.
The last content chapter, page 189. Clear flips the entire identity argument on its head.
He quotes Paul Graham, the essayist and Y Combinator founder, "Keep your identity small. The more you let a single belief define you, the less capable you are of adapting when life challenges you."
Think about what that means. Graham is saying the more labels you attach to yourself, the more brittle you become.
And then Clear writes the most surprising line in the book. The tighter we cling to an identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it.
Wait, chapter 2 says build your identity around your habits. Chapter 20 says don't cling to any identity. These sound contradictory.
They sound contradictory. They're not. But you have to do the work to reconcile them.
The reconciliation is about flexibility. Don't say, "I'm a runner." Say, "I'm the type of person who is mentally tough and loves a physical challenge."
Because "I'm a runner" breaks when you get a knee injury. What are you now? You've lost your identity.
"I'm mentally tough and love a physical challenge" survives in the injury. You swim, you cycle, you do physical therapy with intensity. The identity adapts because it's defined broadly.
Clear uses the example of a soldier becoming a civilian. If your entire identity is built around being in the military, the transition to civilian life can destroy you. But if your identity is, "I'm someone who thrives in disciplined environments and serves a mission larger than myself," you can transfer that to business, to nonprofits, to community work.
And there's a beautiful sports example that illustrates this tension. Pat Riley and the Lakers.
1985-86 season. Riley is coaching the Lakers. Magic Johnson, Kareem, James Worthy. They win the championship, and Riley develops something he calls the Career Best Effort Program, CBE.
Every player tracks their statistics across 40 categories, not just points and rebounds, everything. Deflections, loose balls, screen set. The identity becomes, "I am someone who improves measurably in every dimension."
The Lakers win back-to-back championships in 87 and 88, first team to do it in almost 20 years.
Two consecutive NBA championships, the CBE system worked.
It worked brilliantly, but then Riley promises a three-peat. He tells the media, he tells the fans, "The identity of this team is now, we are the team that never stops improving."
And then what happens?
The team collapses. Exhaustion, injuries, internal conflict. Kareem is 39 and breaking down. Magic is frustrated. They lose to the Pistons in the 89 finals. The bad boys just physically overwhelm them.
The identity of relentless improvement worked until it became a cage. They couldn't scale back, couldn't rest, couldn't adapt. The identity that built them also broke them.
Which is exactly what chapter 20 warns about. Identity is the most powerful tool in the book and also the most dangerous.
The Tao Te Ching puts it best. Men are born soft and supple. Dead, they are stiff and hard. Plants are tender and pliant. Dead, they are brittle and dry.
Thus, whoever is stiff and inflexible is a disciple of death.
Build identity, but keep it flexible. That's the deep lesson of Atomic Habits that almost nobody discusses.
Because most people share the vote metaphor from page 38 and never get to the warning on page 189.
Both pages are essential. You need both.
And nobody else is talking about this. I've listened to probably 30 podcast episodes about Atomic Habits. Every single one covers the vote metaphor, the four laws, the 1% math. Nobody discusses the chapter 20 contradiction.
Because it's complicated. It requires nuance, and nuance doesn't go viral.
The best idea in the book is on page 38. The most important idea in the book is on page 189. And almost nobody reads page 189.
Four gaps. Things Atomic Habits either ignores, glosses over, or borrows without full credit.
Gap 1. Addiction. The book treats all habits as essentially the same mechanism. Flossing, smoking, heroin, scrolling your phone. Same loop, same four laws. But clinical addiction involves neurological changes, dopamine receptor downregulation, physical withdrawal symptoms, genetic predisposition.
You can't make it invisible for an alcoholic whose triggers are everywhere. You can't make it unattractive when withdrawal makes every cell in your body scream for the substance. The four laws are a consumer framework. They don't address clinical conditions.
And the Vietnam heroin study actually proves this point in reverse. Those soldiers who relapsed, the 5%, many of them had pre-existing addiction issues before deployment. Their brains were already wired differently. The environment change helped 95%, but not the 5% with the deepest neurological changes.
Which is exactly the population that most needs help with habits. And the book has nothing for them.
Gap 2, socioeconomic barriers. The advice, design your environment, assumes you control your environment. But if you share a house with six people, if you work two jobs, if you can't afford a gym membership, if healthy food costs three times more than fast food in your neighborhood, your ability to redesign anything is severely limited.
The book is written for knowledge workers in stable housing with disposable income and control over their daily schedule. That's a real audience, but it's not everyone, and the book never acknowledges this limitation.
Think about the Karachi study. Those families couldn't design their water supply. They couldn't choose their neighborhood. They couldn't afford premium soap on their own. It took an external intervention from Procter & Gamble to provide the tools. The habit only became possible when someone else changed the environment for them.
Which is actually a profound point that Clear never makes. Sometimes the most important habit change isn't individual, it's structural, policy, infrastructure, someone else making the environment better so that good habits become possible.
Gap 3, mental health. Depression, anxiety, PTSD, ADHD, these conditions fundamentally alter the reward circuitry the four laws depend on.
Make it satisfying doesn't work when your brain's reward system is impaired, when you can't feel satisfaction, when anhedonia flattens every positive experience. The book assumes a neurotypical brain operating under normal conditions. And ADHD is particularly relevant here, because ADHD fundamentally disrupts the cue-response loop. The cue fires, the craving exists, but the executive function to initiate the response is impaired. That's not a habit problem. That's a neurotransmitter problem.
Telling someone with ADHD to use the 2-minute rule is like telling someone with a broken leg to just start with a short walk. The advice isn't wrong in general. It's wrong for that person.
None of this invalidates the book, but it defines who the book works for and who it doesn't. If you're a middle-class professional trying to exercise more or eat better or read more, this book is excellent. If you're dealing with trauma, poverty, or clinical conditions, it's not enough, and it might make you feel worse, because now you also feel like you're failing at something that's supposed to be simple.
Gap 4, uncredited borrowing. The 2-minute rule is BJ Fogg's Tiny Habits. Clear credits Fogg in Chapter 5, but by Chapter 13, the 2-minute rule has been rebadged as Clear's own concept with no citation.
Commitment devices. The idea of using technology or social pressure to lock in good behavior. That's Thaler and Sunstein's Nudge, published 2008. Clear uses the concept extensively. The credit is thin.
Again, Synthesis is valuable. A great teacher doesn't need to invent calculus. But readers deserve to know where the ideas come from, especially when they're paying for what they think is original thinking.
And there's a fifth gap that nobody talks about: habit conflicts.
What do you mean?
The book treats each habit as independent, but in reality, habits compete with each other for time, energy, and attention. You want to exercise more and sleep more and read more and spend more time with your family. Each one individually follows the four laws, but you can't do all of them. Something has to give.
And the book has no framework for prioritization, for deciding which habits matter most, for accepting that building one habit might mean sacrificing another.
You have 24 hours. You sleep 8, work 8. That leaves 8 hours for every habit you want to build, every system you want to maintain, every relationship you want to invest in.
And the four laws work perfectly for each individual habit, but they say nothing about the portfolio.
It's a book about building habits, not about choosing which habits to build. And choosing might be the harder problem.
Final scores. Let's do this.
BS, 3.5 out of 10, one of the lowest BS scores we've given. For context, episode 1, Poor Charlie's Almanac, got a 2. Episode 2, Thinking Fast and Slow, got a 5. Clear lands in between. He cites his sources, credits most of the original researchers, and mostly avoids unfalsifiable claims. The deductions come from four things: the 1% compound math, which is misleading, the British cycling narrative, which omits doping and funding, the photography class story, which is probably apocryphal, and the Christakis obesity contagion study, which is methodologically contested.
Edge 7.5. Multiple mental models you'll actually use, systems over goals, identity-based habits, the four laws as a diagnostic checklist, the 2-minute rule, implementation intentions, environment design. This book gives you more usable tools per page than most entire self-help libraries.
Replicability 6. If you're a knowledge worker with environmental control, most of this will work. The implementation intentions research is rock solid. The environment design research is strong, but the temptation bundling evidence is thin, and the social influence claims rest on contested studies.
Bottom line.
In episode 1, we said Poor Charlie's Almanac was a wisdom book disguised as an investing book. In episode 2, we said Thinking Fast and Slow was a masterwork with a rotten foundation in chapters 3 and 4.
What's Atomic Habits?
Atomic Habits is a greatest hits album. The DJ didn't write the songs, but the mix is perfect, the sequencing is right, the crowd is dancing, and that has real value.
Read it. Despite being a remix album, Atomic Habits is the best organized behavioral change manual currently available. Clear took 30 years of behavioral science research and made it usable for normal people. That's a genuine contribution.
But know what you're reading. You're reading a synthesis, a greatest hits collection, not original research.
It won't work for everyone. It won't solve addiction. It won't overcome poverty. It won't treat depression or ADHD. But for the target audience, people with a stable environment and neurotypical brain chemistry who want to build better daily systems, there is nothing better on the market. And that audience is enormous. That's why it sold 15 million copies.
And if you want the originals, BJ Fogg's Tiny Habits for the pure behavioral science, De Higgs' Power of Habit for the storytelling, Thalam and Sunstein's Nudge for the policy level theory. But if you only read one book on habits, this is the one because it's the most useful one.
Four takeaways to carry with you.
One.
Page 27. You do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. Winners and losers often have the same goals. The difference is the system.
Every Olympic sprinter wants to win gold. The goal is identical. The systems are wildly different.
Two.
Page 38.
Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become. You don't become a writer by planning to write. You become a writer by writing one sentence today, then two tomorrow. The identity forms from the evidence.
Three.
Self-control is a short-term strategy. Design the environment instead. Remove the cue. The craving never starts. The habit never fires. The Vietnam study, the Karachi study, both prove this.
And four?
The one most people miss.
Page 189. The tighter we cling to an identity, the harder it becomes to grow beyond it. Build your identity through habits, but define it broadly enough to survive when life changes, because life always changes.
That's a wrap on Atomic Habits, episode 3 of BS Killer Book Autopsy.
If you've read this book, and statistically some of you have because 15 million people bought it, tell us which habit actually stuck and which one didn't. We're genuinely curious. We're at bskiller.com.
And if you want to try one thing from this episode, just one, write down an implementation intention tonight. I will blank at blank time in blank place. That's the one backed by the hardest evidence.
Don't try to change your whole life. Change one sentence.
Next episode, we're going deep on a book where the BS score is considerably higher.
Much higher. We're talking double digits on some chapters.
See you then.